Okay, so we'll probably have a session now for about an hour. So do ensure as much as you can that you're sitting comfortably. So to begin to explore this subject of these qualities of metta, and I'm using the Pali quite deliberately, metta, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity, to begin to look at these as pathways of awakening, to begin to look at them as genuine cultivations, to begin to look at them as really almost fruitions of understanding, or the maturation of understanding. Some of you might remember some years ago there was a plane crash in New York when a plane landed on the Hudson River, and quite miraculously everybody survived that crash. And afterwards they did a kind of autopsy on how people handled that experience, which as you can imagine was quite traumatic. And they found there were basically three primary reactions. And please be aware, I'm not being judgmental about any of these reactions, because none of us know how we would be in a situation like that. So the first response that they found many people had was simply to be somewhat frozen in terror, you know, unable really to move or to react or to, you know, to make sense of what was going on. So they were somewhat frozen in their seats. There was a second stream of reactions, which was the survival mechanism, where, you know, people headed for the emergency exits really as quickly as they possibly could, trampling people before them. And then there was a third strand of response, which was a group of people who went carefully up the aisles trying to help the people who were more frail, or people with children, or people who were frozen, trying to help them get out onto the wings. Now, as I say, none of us actually knows which of those we would find ourselves in. We would hope to be in the third category of, you know, the helpful ones, the ones who are caring for those around them. There's no way to actually sort of predict that or guarantee that. I would suggest, actually, if we were well-versed in these qualities of heart-mind, we might have a better chance of being in the third category. Still no guarantees. So these qualities are often referred to as the Brahma Viharas, the sublime abidings of boundless, and this is a word that is used, boundless friendliness, boundless compassion, boundless joy, boundless equanimity. And what these qualities are really pointed to in the teachings is that this actually describes the landscape of the mind of someone who is truly awake. If you want to know what the mind of a Buddha might look like, be one that is really pervaded with these qualities, but they are not considered to be sort of these inaccessible goals. Rather, they actually describe the deepest potential we have as human beings for emotional and psychological freedom. The great genius of the Buddha was actually to build upon what we already know or have already glimpsed in some way in our lives. So when we hear about these qualities, they don't come as, you know, totally alien concepts or possibilities. We have all glimpsed moments of unhesitating kindness, or we may have been on the receiving end of unhesitating kindness. We have all glimpsed moments of unhesitating compassion, or again, may have received this from another. We've all glimpsed moments of joy, or moments of sometimes surprising moments of balance in the midst of the unpredictable and the uncertain. So the genius of the Buddha was really to build upon what on some level we already know, that these are seeds of potentiality, that these are seeds of capacity that lie within each of our hearts. And if any of you are involved in growing anything at all, whether it's growing a plant or growing a child or growing an art or growing a skill, you know that for any of that to actually develop and mature really needs that sense of dedicated cultivation. It doesn't happen on its own. So what the Buddha suggested is that these moments, these glimpses we have of these qualities, they actually don't need to be episodic. You know, moments we bump into and then moments that are forgotten again in the sort of busyness or the habits of our lives and minds. That these are qualities that we train and develop as much as we train and develop our capacities for mindfulness, for wakefulness, for steadiness, so too do we bring these qualities into being. They're described, these qualities are described sometimes as being immeasurables, embracing all in these healing and liberating qualities. Brahma, the word Brahma from Brahmavihara, refers to, you know, the world of the gods and the, you know, ancient Indian kind of teachings. So these are often said to be, they have this divine quality or this awakened quality. And Vihara actually translates as a place where we make our home. The place where we make our home. In Southeast Asia now, Viharas are monasteries. They're the places where we dwell, the places where we abide, but the places psychologically and emotionally where we actually make our home. Not places we periodically visit, but actually our abodes. In the Metta Sutta, and it's worth mentioning that Metta, this quality of Metta, is everyone familiar with that word? Is anybody unfamiliar with that word? Please don't be shy. In the Metta Sutta, and of course Metta is the only one of these qualities that actually merits its own dedicated discourse. But in the Metta Sutta, the Buddha says, when standing, walking, sitting, or lying down, let us establish well this mindfulness. So Metta is described as a sati. It's described as a mindfulness. Let us establish well this mindfulness. This, it is said, is the divine abiding. It's the divine abiding. Now, it's interesting what has happened to the Brahmaviharas over the centuries of the Buddhist teaching taking place in different cultures and societies. You know, sometime about 1,000 years after the Buddha's death, there was an attempt to codify the teachings, so to speak, to sort of gather them all together in one place, you know, and organize them into particular strands of teaching. As I said, this happened it's about 1,000 years after the Buddha's death, and it happened to coincide with a time in India, as far as we know, where there were certain schisms that were happening in the sanghas at that time. Some were becoming very scholastic, some were going into monasteries, others were, you know, establishing their own particular lineages. But in this attempt to codify the teachings, somehow in the Visuddhimagga, which has become the sort of primary codification volume, the Brahmaviharas actually ended up in the concentration section. Nobody quite knows why. Nobody really has an explanation for that, how they ended up in the concentration section. But in a very real way, that's actually the lineage we have inherited. And as we know, in terms of the Buddha's path of awakening, concentration occupies a valid place, a valuable place, but is never seen as a path of awakening. Anyway, here it is. We got the Brahmaviharas stuck in the concentration section, where they became the poor cousins of the insight school. They became something optional extras, you know, somewhat secondary in value to those who are on the real path of insight or awakening. And that is actually how we have often inherited them. You know, the whole kind of template of using particular phrases in a very consistent and constant manner really arose out of this. Before that, there were actually the instructions that were given around metta, the cultivation of metta, were quite different than the ones that we actually inherit today. So, you know, there is a value, and I certainly wouldn't want to belittle that value. There is a value in using metta or any of these qualities as concentration practices. You know, we could all probably benefit from a little bit more collectedness and one-pointedness. But I think in inheriting them in this particular way of just using phrases repetitively, a little bit sort of undermines or diminishes the potentiality for awakening that is held within these development of these qualities. In one of the early texts in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha describes, you know, a range of different paths to awakening through understanding emptiness, you know, awakening through understanding the three characteristics. In one text, it's described as full awakening, actually, through the cultivation of faith and confidence. But he also describes this liberation as chitta-vimutti, the measureless liberation of the heart through the Brahma-viharas of metta, compassion, joy, and equanimity. So it's been something of a passion of mine for the last decade or so to actually sort of really begin to re-examine and to really re-look at what place these qualities actually hold in our own pathways and our understanding of the pathways that we're actually walking. To really begin to explore them in depth and really understanding if they're going to be pathways of awakening, they also need to be pathways of understanding. If they're going to be pathways of awakening, they need to have something to do with understanding how dukkha arises and how dukkha comes to an end. If they're going to be pathways of awakening, they have to have something to do with beginning to cool and uproot greed, hatred, and delusion, because these are the kind of patterns and the toxins that actually really keep us bound individually and collectively to distress. So they need to be approached as pathways of understanding and to see, to begin to examine, what do we learn in the cultivations of these qualities? How are our minds, how are our hearts changed in the cultivation of these qualities? What are they actually offering to us in terms of insight and in terms of transformation? Now, I want to contextualize them even more widely, if I may. First of all, the Brahma-viharas, these qualities, are you okay with me just using this phrase now, the Brahma-viharas? Yeah, when I use it, you know what I'm talking about. So the Brahma-viharas, alive and cultivated moment to moment, they're said to be the guiding principles of all ethical actions. When the Buddha speaks of ethics, he doesn't speak of ethics as a, you know, set of rules, but he actually speaks of ethics as thoughts, words, and acts of metta. And for those of you who were here last night, I just want to pick up something that I said in the ending. For those of you who weren't here, pick up something I said in the ending of the talk last night, that when we are cultivating metta, we have abandoned ill will. When we are cultivating compassion, we have abandoned cruelty and intolerance and harshness. When we are cultivating joyfulness, we have actually abandoned craving. And when we are cultivating equanimity, we have actually, in that moment, abandoned reactivity. We are not practicing those pairs in the same moment ever. Okay? So in terms of ethics, when metta is informing, and I, you know, think about that seriously, what that means. When metta is informing our thoughts, words, and acts, we have in those moments abandoned any cultivation or any embodiment of ill will. So Buddha, the Buddhas I mentioned last night place such a tremendous emphasis upon ethics as being the foundation of everything, of healthy communities, of healthy societies, of healthy relationships with others and with ourselves, that all of this actually rests upon a deep understanding of ethics, beyond ethics being just a set of rules. So that kind of thriving as individuals and thriving collectively really relies upon our cultivation of metta as being the guiding energy of our thoughts, words, and acts. That's quite an invitation, isn't it? It's quite an invitation. Because, you know, we I think, see and appreciate how, you know, easily we are drawn into the habits and the patterns of ill will, of craving, of harshness, of reactivity. I mean, so we appreciate, I think, the size of the cloth of really living an ethical life. And again, it's so important when we hear this in the teaching that, you know, it doesn't become the source of some new judgment commentary, you know, that I'm not good enough and, you know, look what I said yesterday, you know, and, you know, look what I thought 5 minutes ago, you know. It's not meant to be the basis of a new judgment commentary. It's really meant to be to evoke a sense of aspiration and a sense of possibility, and to consider what our lives would look like if our thoughts, words, and acts were really deeply rooted in these qualities. This is a good vision to explore and to reflect upon. So the Buddha spoke about these qualities as being the basis of all ethical action, but they're also the training in intention, inclining the mind towards our capacity to meet our world inwardly and outwardly with kindness, with compassion, with joyfulness, with equanimity. So they're trainings in intentionality. And it is often, you know, said in this teaching that the whole of the path rests upon the tip of the pin of intention. That intention precedes our thoughts, precedes our words, precedes our acts. And the whole development of mindfulness, the whole development of a meditative pathway, in many ways is a movement from a life that is governed by impulse, governed by compulsion, governed by reactivity, into a life that is guided by intention. This is also, of course, really a very profound shift, because to have a life guided by intention requires a good deal of mindfulness inwardly, a good deal of awareness inwardly, and a good deal of commitment inwardly. And yet this was always the invitation of this teaching to live an intentional life. To live an intentional life. Being aware in Buddhist psychology, this word for intention is actually also, this word for volition, it's also karma. This is karma. Karma is action. Karma is no more than action. Verbal actions, thought actions, bodily actions. Karma is action. So this is actually what, it is intention that moves action, moves us into activity. So there are training intentions. I mean, the Buddha saw, as we see, you know, and cannot help but see, the pervasiveness of greed and hatred and delusion that, you know, can torment us individually and universally. and how that, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion, as the Buddha pointed out, these are the deeply rooted habit patterns that create and recreate dukkha. You know, the teachings are so clear that dukkha is not, preordained, that dukkha is not a life sentence, that distress and struggle is something that is created and recreated through confusion and misunderstanding, and often through the enactment or the power, the actual power of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I know those are very big words, aren't they? I mean, most of us would not be so prone to describe ourselves as being sort of a greedy type, or, you know, filled with hate, you know, or filled with, delusion. And, you know, of course we wouldn't do that, otherwise we wouldn't be here, we'd be doing something else. But actually there's always a continuum in these things that the Buddha talks about. So greed, hatred, and delusion are often said to be the sort of three manifestations of avidya or ignorance. And guess what the five manifestations of greed, hatred, and delusion are? The five hindrances. Yeah? Craving for sensual pleasure, you know, aversion, numbness, restlessness and worry, doubt. Isn't this how, you know, when we start to use that language, we start to feel a bit more, oh yeah, I know those, you know. I actually know those. I can identify with those, you know, possibly more than we would like. But actually to see that continuum, I think, is really quite powerful. These are how greed, hatred, and delusion actually manifest. But these are very accessible to us, aren't they, as patterns and as moods? As patterns and as moods, the five hindrances? You know, how many do we see of those patterns in a single day? Again, probably more than we would like. So we really have to contextualize these Brahmaviharas, because they have a classroom, you know? They have a classroom, and the classroom is not just in our moment-to-moment experience. The classroom is in the classroom of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know? And the classroom is the most visible classroom is often in those patterns and mind states of the five hindrances. So these are always cultivations developed within a classroom. It is also, I think, I'm just actually kind of setting the scene, by the way. I might set the scene the whole weekend. Really. So, the Brahmaviharas, this is also what widens the field of our concern. It's what widens the field of our practice, because the Brahmaviharas are certainly not concerned solely with personal inner development. That's part of it. But these are relational qualities. These are about how we live in this world, how we live with people we struggle with, how we live with people we love, how we live with people we don't know, how we live with our own personal world of mind, body, events, and experience. So they're actually concerned with if I put it in a very non-Buddhist way, they are concerned with self-respect and respect for others. They're concerned with dignity. They're concerned with living without regret in our relational world. You know, they're concerned with living and touching this world in the freest way possible. So they are said to be the cause of peacemaking. Said to be the cause of peacemaking. They're talked about the ways to heal conflict and division. They're talked about the ways to bring unity in places of estrangement and alienation. The ways to bring about cooperation and trust between people and within communities. So I think it is very important to contextualize them in this way, because this is not something that is cultivated just sitting on our cushion with our eyes closed. This is about how we meet life and how we meet, as we all know, the spectrum of challenges in our cultures today, which is so easily able to trigger yet more greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, I sometimes feel despairing of the ways that, you know, I think in our cultures we have gone so far in terms of naturalizing greed. You know, this is just a normal way to live, you know. This is what it means to be a human being, is to want and to have and to get. And this somehow says something about who we are. And we actually know how, you know, I went for a little walk earlier, so there's an Eileen Fisher, the factory sale over the road, the lines going round the block. I mean, Eileen Fisher does some nice things, no doubt, you know. But you know, this way that we are so geared to want, you know, to want even what we don't need. And I fear for the ways that we are beginning to naturalize hatred and ill will in our vocabulary, in our language, in the creation of the other as being a legitimate target of ill will and fear and suspicion and mistrust. You know, the tendency in that to pursue a greater, ever greater sense of self-protection and isolationism. And the ways, you know, that this is the easy way out. You know, the Brahmaviharas are not the easy way out. You know, when the Buddha speaks about swimming against the tide, about this pathway of being one of swimming against the tide, it is truly that. You know, it's swimming against the tide of our own patterning, you know, and our own fears and anxieties and greeds and hatreds. But it's much bigger than that, because when we think about these practices as being so relational, this is also swimming against the tide, actually often, of many social mores. You know, this is countercultural in some ways, you know, and in many ways it's counterintuitive. And you know that was as true in the time in the Buddha as it is now. Okay? So it's not feeling like this is some new tide that is being swum against. You know, the Buddha lived in a culture, a society that was riven with, you know, isolationism and, you know, self-protection and wars and conflict, you know. So it has always been a swimming against the tide. Now, the Brahmaviharas, as meditative traditions, they are inextricably interwoven with mindfulness, with sati. You know, because as I mentioned, we have all bumped into moments of these qualities. But if they're going to be really brought to fruition, I think really they need to be undertaken as meditative pathways. It's almost you see the marriage of mindfulness and these qualities. You know, if you look at the intention of mindfulness, it is actually to turn towards. It's to turn towards the present moment. It's a behavioral gesture of the mind to turn towards the present moment. This is already sort of counterintuitive, isn't it? Because we can spend so much of our waking moments turning away from what is, yeah? Into habits, into forgetfulness, into distractedness. So the intention of mindfulness is always to turn towards the present moment. And the intention of the Brahmaviharas is to befriend that which is turned towards, to find compassion within that which is turned towards, to find joyfulness and to stand in the middle of. So there's this necessary marriage between awareness and the Brahmaviharas. And if we look at the right time, the appropriate moment to cultivate these qualities, generally not the most ideal moments in our lives, but any moment of aversion, any moment of greed, you know, any moment of being knocked off balance, any moment of being lost in despair, these are the appropriate moments. These are the classrooms, the appropriate moments for the development of these qualities. And these qualities are called immeasurables or boundless states because of their inclusivity, because they are not defined by preferences or partiality. It's kind of, this is again, it doesn't matter how we feel about things or about people. It doesn't matter whether we like them or not. It doesn't matter whether we feel someone is worthy of kindness or compassion or not. You know, it doesn't matter that things can feel quite broken or that we're, afraid. This is where we learn to surrender that partiality and preference nature of our attention. That's an interesting one that has quite a big scope. You know, I mean, I think there's a lot of research that really reveals how preferential our attention span actually is. And interestingly, you know, the majority of our attention preferences not the lovely, but the unlovely. Yeah. You know, we remember hurts and insults and offenses far more readily than we remember moments of kindness. You know, our attention, you know, and from a perspective of evolutionary science, this is understandable. Our attention is often drawn to what is imperfect or what is wrong, but is usually drawn with the kind of attention that is drawn is usually fearful or anxious or aversive. So there is an impartiality, a kind of training in intention and attention. Have you noticed that intention and attention rise and fall together? When intention collapses, attention collapses. When attention collapses, intention collapses. Have you noticed that? So, you know, in terms of our practice and our lives, learning to sustain one is learning to sustain the other. Okay? So these are mutually supportive. And they're mutually supportive in this inclusivity. It's like Ajahn Sumedho, he once put it, he says, it's not difficult for me to feel kindness towards things that I like, such as kittens and puppies, cute children and pleasant people who say nice things about me, sunny weather, etc. I have no problem with any of this. But what should I do when people are, things are nasty and foul? And so you can guess, I think you can guess the answer. This is the classroom of cultivating the Brahmaviharas. Now, coming back to this, the Brahmaviharas are not just about what we feel. They're actually deeply concerned with what we do, how we act, how we live, how we respond as we move through this world. This was always very hard for me to get as a young practitioner, you know, who really thought, you know, really was a, you know, a full-blown card-carrying member of the authenticity of how I feel ideology, you know, being the ultimate authority in all things, you know, if I feel good about something, I do it, you know, if I don't feel good about something, I don't do it, you know, and my feeling tells me that is, you know, that's authentic, that's true. Well, this teaching is a myth buster in that one, you know. You know, my early teacher said to me, if you want to know what generosity feels like, be generous. Yeah. If you want to know what compassion feels like, act compassionately. Yeah. If you want to know what kindness feels like, act and speak kindly. You know, and there's a lot in this teaching, you know, which may surprise us. It's not usually presented as an inward-out development. You know, that I get it all together inwardly and then I manifest that in my thoughts, words, and acts. It's often presented as an outward-in pathway. So it's often presented, the whole development of this teaching, there's a big piece which is being presented as being behaviorally led, which often runs against the tide of how we feel. I mean, can you imagine if you're on retreat and And the teacher said to you, only come and sit if you really, really feel like it. And if you don't bother, you know. Oh, only go and walk if you really, really feel like it. And if you don't feel like it, you know, take a nap. You imagine how that would be? And how many times you have found yourself in retreat environments, whatever, you don't feel like going to sit. You don't feel like going to walk. How many of you as parents have got up at the 3 a.m. cry? You know, do you really feel like it? You know? We don't. How many times in our lives do it, you know, when we might be feeling like overfull and someone reaches out to us for help and we don't feel like it, but we show up. So there's so much in this pathway which is actually really outwardly in presented, you know, that we are actually guided, we are actually not giving authority so much to our moods, our mind states, the emotions of the moment. We are actually giving authority to the intentions that we know to be wholesome and liberating. That's a big shift, I think, for a lot of us. To not have a life that is simply governed by the prevailing mood of the moment, but to have a life that is actually guided by the intentions that we honor and aspire to. Does that make sense to you? You know, it's certainly the first big step we take, I think, in this process of waking up, you know, that we have reflected upon what we value. You know, we have reflected on what it is worthy to commit ourselves to, what it is worthy to nurture. And we learn actually to foster and to embody those intentions through the spectrum of moods, the spectrum of emotions, the spectrum of patterns that arise for us. It is so easy to be distracted. There's a wonderful Zen teaching that says, you know, when you sit, just sit. When you walk, just walk. Above all, don't wobble. Yeah? And we know about wobbling, don't we? We know about wobbling. And we know actually that wobbling basically keeps us kind of stuck in place. So they're not about what we feel, they're about what we're dedicated to. Okay, so that's a good moment for a pause. Are there any questions, any reflections? You with me? Yeah.
So there's a sense of you may have an intention, but sometimes the impact isn't what you expect.
Right.
So there must be some, I just hope you speak on that, it occurs to me there's some disconnect between maybe your intention or their perception of the world's intention.
So did you hear the question? So the question was, you know, you can have an intention which you feel to be wholesome, ethical, and the impact of it is quite different than what you anticipated, that it's received or in ways that we don't foresee. I would mention it, and thank you for raising that, you know, in this cultivation of intentionality, the Buddha also said it's not enough to have good intentions, that we actually also are asked to actually consider to the best of our ability the consequences of those intentions. So this widens the field of that investigation. For example, I might have the intention to say something to you that I feel would be helpful, but you don't want to hear. Well, it's not okay for me just to barge ahead with that intention. I need to consider, you know, how will this land? Is it the right time? Is it the right moment? Is it spoken in a way that can be heard? You know, is this an engagement or is this me imposing my intention upon someone who's not the slightest bit interested in? And so it is that consideration to the best of our ability to reflect upon outcomes and where this goes. Now, I say that to the best of our ability very clearly, because sometimes it is simply so unpredictable, you know, and so unexpected, that we also need to actually be able to stand in the middle of that, you know, and to know that that's not necessarily the end of the story, you know, that possibly some new intentionality or some new response is actually brought in here. Now, when the Buddha speaks about intention, you know, he gets very simple about the three skillful intentions, you know, the intention of kindness, the intention of compassion, the intention of non-clinging, you know, and that non-clinging part also includes non-clinging to the outcomes of our speech, thoughts, and acts, you know. So, but thank you for raising that. It is important. How does this land in the world? Is it the right moment? Is it the right time? Is, you know, is it the right tone, for example, in speech? Well, I think actually what you're making a very important distinction here between sort of having a kind of background view that I never mean to be harmful, you know? That's a kind of background view. It's a sort of an assumption to move from that place into an active, engaged intention that is actually really applied to my speech and my choices and my deeds and my thoughts. This is moving into quite a different domain than that asks for much more inquiry, much more investigation than just having this assumption, of course I don't mean to do any harm. You know, it's easy to say that, you know, without actually bringing our moment-to-moment experience into the light of that as a sort of active intention, which I think is what we're being actually asked to do in this practice, is not to kind of hang out in this kind of comfortable view, you know, that makes me feel pretty good, you know. That, of course, I don't mean to harm anybody. Oh, but I'm harming. How's that happen? You know? Or someone's hurt, or someone feels injured, or I injure myself, you know. And all of those are kind of really, I agree with you, totally engaged investigations, because, you know, in a way I can be quiet. I can learn, say, not to speak harshly or not to kill things, much more easily than I can learn to think without ill will. That is a whole nother domain, to actually have my thinking processes and my emotional processes arising free of ill will. That's a much more challenging domain, because, you know, also they're the ones, we're the only ones that know, until they actually spill out into thoughts or acts. But yes, the engaged part of that moment-to-moment reflection is clearly so needed, you know, if it's going to make any difference. You know, views don't really make that much of a difference. Yeah. So a little bit more perspective on the difference between, so the Brahmaviharas as a mindfulness or as a concentration practice. It depends a lot in terms of actual practical cultivation. Depends a lot on how they're actually developed. You know, I think if we're relying upon the Brahmaviharas basically as a concentration practice, you know, the something like the phrases become all important. You know, the repetition of the phrases becomes all important. You know, we don't, you know, it's like if you were using your breath as a concentration practice. You know, it's kind of the exclusive nature of the attention that actually allows the concentration to develop. You know, so the intention is to have an object of meditation, and you're basically not interested in anything outside of that object, you know? So immediately you come back to the object. So you can use mindfulness of breathing in that way. You can also use something like a metta practice in that way. You know, where you just, your intention is really to keep the mind very, very focused simply on repeating the phrases. Now, there's a value in doing that, because the value is that your attention is not going to be doing two things at the same time. So when you're actually cultivating, for example, the repetition of the phrases, you're not cultivating distractedness, spaciness, fragmentation. You know, you're actually really training the mind to have that resting, adhering power to its object. In terms of psychological process, for example, metta practice used as a concentration practice can be a great ally in actually calming patterns of rumination and obsession, because we're actually not going to be ruminating and obsessing and repeating the phrases in the same moment. So there's a value in that. If you are going to be using, for example, the formal practices more as an insight practice, first of all, you yield that exclusivity. You know. So, you know, the qualities of metta, compassion, joy are brought to whatever appears on your screen. You know, the thoughts, the emotions, the sounds, the encounters, the events, you know, the people, the body, you know. So these qualities are actually brought. You might still use the phrases, because they can be skillful means, you know, they can be skillful means. And I'll talk about this a little bit more. But you would probably change the phrases, you know. Setting them as an intention in the mind, and if you use the phrases, to use them much more as a listening practice rather than a constant repetition. You know, almost as if you were dropping a pebble into a well, that you actually listen to the echo. You know, may I be peaceful. Ah. Rest with that. Listen to what arises around that. So you use it much more as a listening practice rather than as a full-on constant repetition. Yeah. Yes, please. Did you hear the question? So the question is around thought, that hearing teachings that we're not responsible for our thoughts, that thoughts arise and pass just in the sense door of the mind, just like sounds arise and pass in the sense door of the ear, you know? And the other perspective, that perhaps we are responsible for our thoughts, and perhaps we're hoping to move to in a direction where our thoughts are actually not colored and flavored by greed, hatred, and delusion. I'm rephrasing what you said, but does it capture it?
Yes.
Okay. So on one level, we are never responsible. We don't choose what arises in the sense doors. We don't choose what sounds appear and pass away. The mind will have thoughts. This is the nature of a mind, is to have thoughts. The roots of those thoughts, and we're not, you know, well, to some extent, we are in control of that. You know, when the Buddha, or responsible for it, when the Buddha really speaks about a well-trained mind, he says, one who thinks the thoughts they want to think when they want to think them, and one who doesn't think the thoughts they don't need to think. You get the picture. So the Buddha's actually really pointing towards a mind that is actually, you know, it will still have thoughts, but appropriate thinking, okay? Now, you know, if we were honestly look at the sort of spectrum of our thoughts in a single day, you know, probably about 98% are somewhat irrelevant to the moment. I mean, that might be overstating it. You know, perhaps the percentage is slightly lower, but I bet it's in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Now, some of those are quite just benign, aren't they? They're just kind of floating through, and they're really just really kind of talking about a mind that's not very collected or gathered or perhaps not so well trained. But of course, many of those thoughts really are carrying the kind of visible expression of patterns of you know, anxiety, ill will, of fear, of anger, of you know, all kinds of patterns that are helpful for us. Now, what we do see very clearly in our experience that you know, what we call unwholesome or unskillful patterns are much bigger generators of narrative than skillful or wholesome qualities of heart and mind. You know, moments of joy, we don't sit there and speculate endlessly about whether we deserve it or, you know, where it came from or, you know, why it's there. You know, we don't tend to weave a big story about it. But, you know, we can really see around fear or anger, you know, ill will, self, you know, the level of thought generation is much bigger and much louder. So, you know, the suggestion within the training of the mind and meditative development is that as you begin to unbind from those patterns, you're also unbinding from the narratives. Which is actually why concentration alone is often not said to be a path of liberation, because you can train the mind to think less through concentration, but not necessarily to undo the patterning that generates the narrative. So yes, there is an aspiration here. There is an aspiration here to really cultivate a mind that is truly a friend, that is actually not rooted in this kind of patterning. And then your mind will get quieter. It will get much stiller. Well, yes. I'm sorry.
I can try to speak louder.
Okay. I mean, yes, I think, so the question is that in terms of the Brahma-Viharas, to understand that sometimes that is behaviorally led, we act with kindness, we act with compassion, whereas cultivating a collected mind or a mind that is a friend is more internally led. I would say both. That cultivating a mind that's a friend is both internally and externally led. Because, for example, look at how we move through the world. You know, even here, have you noticed, say, in a walking period, have you noticed sometimes how your eyes are doing something quite different than your intention to be embodied? You know, that your intention is to walk, but your eyes are kind of just really busy, you know, prowling the world. You know, I remember when we used to teach out at, what's the university we used to have? Bastyr. We used to Bastyr, you know, and like most places, well, a little bit like here too, you know, the walls are plastered with, you know, information that's of no interest or relevance to you whatsoever, you know. And people would do a walking meditation, come back, you know, they've read every job description, not interested in applying for that job. They know about all the apartments that are for rent, you know. They know everything, you know. It's completely irrelevant to anything that they need. And that's how we cultivate distractedness. That's how we cultivate a mind that is actually not a friend, that is just always hooked by a kind of hunger to be entertained, or a hunger to be busy. So I do feel actually that samadhi, or the sense of collectiveness, is probably both an external behavioral cultivation and an internal cultivation. Part of it, I think, is really sensing how we move through the world and how we're actually cultivating the sense of unification of body, mind, and present moment. You know, rather than living from, you know, the body starting here down and you know, the mind starting here up, you know, and never the twain shall meet, you know. You know, to really actually, you know, to know the moments where we can actually be truly collected and focused. I think of it as airport practice, you know. You go in an airport terminal, you know, and there's all this stuff that's shouting at you, you know, buy me, look at me. You just got to keep your eye on what you need to do, you know, where you're going, rather than this kind of fragmented way of being. So that's the external part. And I think it's not about being cultivated where we lose spatial awareness, because, you know, you walk down the street here, you need spatial awareness. Good idea, you know. But you don't need to be hungry. That's different. Spatial awareness is different than having awareness that is kind of entertainment craving bit driven. In terms of inner collectedness, you know, I think, you know, the first two dimensions of mindfulness, I mean, I would think of there being four primary dimensions of mindfulness. But the first two dimensions of mindfulness, the first of them is the cultivation of the simple knowing, and the second of these is the cultivation of what is called protective awareness. So the simple knowing is part of that cultivation inwardly, to know the body as the body, to know the breathing as the breathing, to begin to develop this sense of being able to sustain attentiveness. That's quite hard often. Not just to have attentiveness, but we have to sustain attentiveness. This is really part of the meditative art, quite frankly. But the other aspect that supports that is protective awareness. And quite honestly, we all need to know a little bit more about being our own gatekeepers. You know, the protective awareness is often, you know, the image that's used is the sentry who stands at the gates of the city, you know, welcoming in everyone who's there to serve the well-being of the city well, and just saying a polite no to those who are intent on sort of sabotaging the well-being of the city. I think we all need to know a little bit more about being our own gatekeeper, the gatekeeper at the sense doors. You know, do those thoughts serve well? You know, welcome, you know, do they not serve well? A polite recognition and thank you, but no, I'm coming back to the body, or I'm coming back to the breathing, rather than just, you know, this kind of unconditional admittance of everything that really doesn't serve us well. And I think these two together, the ability to know, to sustain attention, to know things as they are, that's the first step in stepping out of the eye of the storm. But to be the gatekeeper, this applies to what we do on a cushion and applies to what we do off a cushion. How much we actually practice that sense of knowing what is helpful and what is unhelpful. You know, what it's skillful to welcome and what it's skillful just to say thank you, but no. So I think of it as both an internal and external cultivation. Yes, please.
Excuse me, last night you mentioned, as you talked about before, your commitments over time, like for the last year and a half, you've been focusing on the practice, and I didn't quite catch all of that, but I thought I heard the word impartial, and I was wondering how it ties into what you're talking about.
No, I what I was just said last night, I've had a practice over a year more, almost 2 years, of having a commitment to not having neutral people in my life. Well, you know, there's so many, you know, I think of it because I travel a lot, and I think of this really exemplifies this. You know, I think about how many people are involved in actually easing my way through this world You know, people who work in hotels, people who work in restaurants, people who work in airlines, people who load baggage onto planes. And I think about how many of those people that actually come into my field of visibility that it's easy not to see. It's easy not to see. How often we see people who have a personal meaning to us. We either like them because we have things in common and share a history, or we dislike them for whatever reason. And in that middle spectrum, we just tend to ignore. We just tend to ignore, to actually not see. You know, so to actually really cultivate that capacity. And you think about core human longings. You know, I would say one of the core human longings is actually to be seen, to be visible, to be respected, and how easy it is to gloss over all of those who come into our world because they actually either neither flattering or threatening us. And actually, to actually see, you know, it is, like I mentioned, for me, it's been a very insightful practice and actually changed how I move through the world. Yes, to actually see the very human story held within that person without them having to tell me that very human story. Yeah. Yes, please. And how does that sit alongside the first part of your comment about non-self? How are you placing anatta in all of that? How are you placing anatta? Yes, very much so. I mean, I think in terms of insight practices, all of the Brahmaviharas are engaged in reducing the view of reducing self-view and self-contractedness, you know. And anatta, of course, does not mean no self. It means not holding to views of self, you know, non-self. So, of course, you know, you really actually see in terms of unwholesome qualities how they're implicated in self-building, you know. I need, I want, I hate, I don't like, you know, I insist on. How all unwholesome qualities are implicated in self-building. So the Brahmaviharas are certainly implicated in lowering the tone of selfing. For example, you know, an act of generosity, whether I feel like it or not, kind of challenges also the self-view that I don't have enough or I shouldn't give this. So it is changing the lens of how we see the world. You know, we are always seeing the world through a certain lens. in. Often we don't know we're seeing the world through a certain lens until we bump up against someone who's seeing the world through a different lens. But, you know, there is actually no such thing as bare attention. You know, our attention is always flavored by something. So what we're actually taking care of here are the roots from which, you know, our ethics are established, our mindfulness is established, you know, the way that our thinking is established. We're trying to take care of the kind of foundations from which all things arise. I don't know if that answers your question. I'm thinking you're probably ready to move. Are you ready to move? So, why don't we take a walking period for half an hour? Then we'll come in and we'll just try and finish up this introductory piece. I am on page 3 of 35. Try and finish up this introductory piece and then have a short sit before lunch. How about, does that sound a reasonable proposition? So let's come back at 5 to 12, and I really encourage you, you know, as much as possible, really use this as a walking period, you know, digestion period. And then we'll come back at 5 to 12 and finish up this sort of introductory piece, and then we'll have a short sit before lunch. Great. Thank you very much.